Well, we're gonna start now, and of course I got my notes because I usually end up forgetting something somewhere along the lines. Thank you very much for coming. We appreciate it. My name is Carmen DeJovine. I'm with the company 6 Degrees of Freedom. It's a rehabilitation engineering firm, and my co-presenter is Tina Rossler, and I'll let her tell you a little bit about herself.
I'm a PT, and I'm the director of sales and education for Tylight Wheelchairs.
So, we're taking a different perspective on kind of the tools that you would use in a clinical setting. Our focus is very assistive technology focused, very clinically focused, and Tina and I are bringing a unique perspective to the use of tools in the clinical setting in the fact that she is a physical therapist and I'm an engineer. So there's this nice, dichotomy here that allows us to kind of give you an overview of how you could use these tools in the clinical setting, and really, the first half of our presentation is going, as long as everything works out well, is really going to describe how you use these tools within the whole service delivery process. So our goal is not only to talk about the tools that you could potentially use and give you case studies of how you could use them, but also to justify, if you're a clinician, rehab practitioner, justify how you to your boss, how you could use these, or why you should buy these tools, why you should include tests and measurements within your service delivery process. So that's really the overarching goal, is not just to talk about these neat little gadgets, but to kind of put them in perspective, into context within the whole administrative process even.
And to talk about the different roles that each of us play in the utilization of the tools, and really how that comes back to evidence-based practice, because how I might use a tool might be different than how an engineer uses a tool, for different reasons.
So just quickly, we're just going to go over the objectives. We're going to talk about at least 6 tools. We have quite a few that I brought with me. We have quite a few that we're going to show. We're going to define the functional measure for each tool, and this goes into the example that Tina's going to talk about a little bit more is the goniometer. There's a set standard, a set way of using it, and we're going to talk about what you can and cannot measure with these different tools, how you integrate them into the service delivery process. We're going to start defining what is low tech, what is medium tech, what is high tech, and then we're going to analyze the results of how we use these. And they're very simple, you know, within an hour and 15 minutes, very simple examples of how we use them.
One of the things we want to point out, though, is that we want to get back to talking about tools from an evidence-based practice standpoint. A lot of these tools that we're using are validated. They're supposed to be used in a certain way. This was from Dr. Kirby's presentation last year when he talks about the big circle is our practice. That's our scope of practice. And the amount of evidence-based practice that we actually see and do out in the field is really very small. And over time, we want to see that evidence-based practice overlap more with what we're actually doing in the clinic. And we talk about some examples, even with tool utilization, how things just become kind of commonplace. It's what we did before, and we don't really look to the evidence or look to how things change. a lot of our current assessment is not based on evidence. It's based more on ritual. We're getting a subjective observation of the client, but we're not necessarily always recording information. Knowledge or history with similar clients. I've seen this type of client with this diagnosis multiple times, so it tends to lead me down a certain path. And we all do that from time to time, and it's part of what we need to do, but it shouldn't be the only part. I bring up funding perceptions a lot. I walk into a lot of clinics where they're looking at equipment, and they say, right off the bat, they don't even look at the person. They don't do a evaluation or an assessment of the person. They say, oh, this is the funding source. These are the only things we're going to even look at. We want to try to get away from that because sometimes there are alternative funding methods that we can use, or we can use the evidence to justify a different level of service or product. And again, the we used it once, let's try it again. There's nothing wrong with that. But if it starts to not work, we need to look back at how we're justifying it.
And I just wanted to echo the point of you don't want funding driving your decisions. You want the information in front of you, your assessment process, to drive your decisions.
Really, it should be a synergy, and we look at it as a synergy not just between clinical practice, but the research, the product development, and the evidence-based practice all needs to work together, and there's going to be a transfer of information, or there should be, back and forth across that whole continuum. So it's not just one group of people doing it. It's not we get the research, then we bring it to the clinic, or then we bring it to product development. It could be identify a problem in the clinic. I've researched it and know what the basis for that is. And then maybe now I can develop a product or some kind of tool to use to help either assess it or address that problem. And it can go the opposite direction. There might be a tool out there that we're not using really clinically, and I might start to use it clinically and see how it can be applied, and then research might come. It's not necessarily the perfect way to do it, but a lot of that synergy needs to happen more often.
So one of the things that I like to bring up, and I found this, I don't have a great reference for this, but I've seen it in other presentations, other individuals have used it, of just three simple ways to describe evidence-based practice. And you have your external evidence, and that's where you're gaining knowledge from the researchers and bringing it down into your own clinical setting. You have your knowledge and skills of the rehab professional. That's your own knowledge and skills that we've talked about. And then it's applying that evidence-based practice to an individual. And that is what is so important, is to be able to make that link between the consumer, the characteristics of that consumer within whatever context you're looking at, and being able to relate it to the research. And that helps so much from the funding standpoint. If you can say, from a research standpoint, you know, you want to lower the forces during manual wheelchair propulsion. And, hey, we have a tool that shows that we are able to increase the stroke length, or we have a tool that that can decrease the force, shows that we can decrease the forces by using one wheelchair over another. And so that's how you take the research and apply it to a specific individual.
And it gives us something to document our knowledge that we know.
And this is just a kind of a diagram of, you know, you've got this knowledge translation, this continuum of going from external evidence to the practitioner's own experience to what is the individual's own experience, or what is the evidence related to that individual. And that's what we're going to talk about a little today. But the next slide shows that oftentimes that's not happening. It's not getting to that level of taking measurements, taking the time to take measurements. And one of the most interesting things that I found out at this conference is the talk of ways to bill for these services, these test and measurement services, within your service delivery process.
And everybody always asks, and we all know this and we've heard it over and over, is why quantitative data is so important. There are demands now for more third-party payers and the government funding agencies who are saying there is no evidence that supports that this person needs this type of equipment. We need to be better at finding that evidence. There's places where it's readily available, and documenting ourselves, even if it's just the information that we've gathered over years of clinical practice, of documenting it and showing them documentation. We all know there is very limited time for assessment and reassessment. As Carmen said, we've learned a lot in this conference about how we can bill for services as a group. It might not only be the PT or the OT or the RET or the ATS that's doing it. It's kind of a joint effort, and different people can sometimes bill for different portions of that. We really need to validate our clinical practice and product development. We need to support our documentation, and a lot of times this information can be used for justification. A lot of times if I get denials, I'll get a request for prove this to me. And if I can have a well-written study or a clinical practice guideline or a position paper perhaps that ResNA has posted to their website, and I can provide that, that gives me one more piece of leverage to use with my funding sources. It also strengthens our profession. That brings us back to the idea of standards of practice. And I think this works into this because we're talking about how standards are used to figure out how these tools work. But also we want to look at our professional standards of practice. Standards of practice are typically designed to define what the profession is, what the scope of practice is, and what methods and instrumentation those practices use. And it really provides a guide for conduct and a code of ethics. Now, as a physical therapist, there is a very large manual from the APTA on our standards of practice. And it actually goes down to certain levels of saying this diagnosis, these are the types of special tests, these are the types of tools that might be used. It doesn't dictate exactly how they're utilized for each client, but it gives you guidelines to go by. And that is something that's published and readily available to all government agencies. And it really helps kind of strengthen the profession and gives us guidelines to compare things to. Even in litigation, for example, it's very important to have things like that. There are varying levels. If you look at NARTS, the National Registry of Rehab Technology Suppliers. And RESNA, there are standards of practice for those organizations, but they're in various levels of implementation and completeness, I think.
Right, and that's one of the things with RESNA and rehabilitation engineering in general, is those practice guidelines have not come into play. So what we're talking about could potentially become some sort of practice guidelines. How do you use these tools in the future? What is the most appropriate way? When is it appropriate to use it? And what decisions should you make based on the information that you have obtained using tools?
And standards of practice are continually changing. So the APTA might republish it every 3 to 5 years, but they're constantly working on it and updating and changing it as practice changes. We want to tell you the difference between that and clinical practice guidelines. Clinical practice guidelines, like I believe Kendra presented a full day on these ones, the upper extremity preservation guidelines, really focus on a specific clinical issue or related to one area, but it tends to be multidisciplinary in nature. So this might cross over between PT, OT, rehab engineering, suppliers, and it's really collaboration and a great example of evidence-based practice with clinical research and product development people. And it then becomes relevant to standards of practice. So as we take research, we start utilizing it in the clinic and developing things based on it, we can develop clinical practice guidelines that can really go across a multidisciplinary group. And each group might choose in their standards of practice to utilize that differently.
This is one of my favorite slides. Tina and I actually spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out how does a therapist differ from an engineer, how does an engineer differ from a therapist, and how do we bring those two together. And one of the things that we really have defined is that the therapist has that human evaluation, a physical therapy evaluation. They're looking at it from the human standpoint. They've got their core guidelines, the core areas that they're looking at, and they're bringing it into how does that person interact with the assistive technology. The engineer also has the human at the center, but is looking at it from the technology side. How do we bring these pieces together? What are the most appropriate pieces, and how do we use the information that we gather to make appropriate decisions? So it's the same process. It's just different perspectives on it, and it's bringing those perspectives together and working together in a clinical setting that allows us to get better outcomes for the consumer in the end or for the patient, depending on what environment that you're working in.
I think it's important to point out that there's a lot of overlap between certain areas of all of our professions. I always hear, well, you're a PT and I'm an OT. How can we be doing the same thing? Well, it's because there is some overlap. Especially, I think, when it comes to assistive technology, it's not well defined by many of the professional organizations whose role and responsibility exactly it is. And I've practiced in different areas of the country. It varies from place to place. It varies from country to country. It varies from region to region, even in the U.S., how it's approached and whose responsibility it is.
So I'd just like to point out, in starting a company, in starting Six Degrees of Freedom, one of the things that I was looking at was what is the assistive technology assessment process, service delivery process. But then I happened to look in other areas like engineering, just straight engineering. I looked into areas like physical therapy, occupational therapy, what are their guidelines? And it's amazing, we all have the same thing. We all have the same ideas. We analyze, we synthesize, or we brainstorm what possible solutions are, and then we're supposed to evaluate. And oftentimes that analysis part, the data gathering part, gets shortchanged. And that's oftentimes where an engineer can come in place and provide a little guidance about what measures do we need to take. And that evaluation component is actually gathering the equipment and trying it out with the consumer. And it is so important to do that, because then that allows you to give objective results of will this or won't it work, or what do we need to tweak for that individual. And this is just kind of the whole process from start to end, from referral to follow up and follow along. And we've just indicated little red lines where quantitative tools are important to this process, and you can see they're important throughout. During the assessment process, it gives you a baseline, allows you to make decisions. Implementation, well, let's repeat what we did during the evaluation component. Follow-up and follow-along allows us to see if things have changed, are there problems, what problems or issues do we need to address at this point in time.
It becomes even more important, I think, with follow-along. Sorry about that, I have all these pop-ups. Because it gives us something to compare. If we start at the assessment phase and do that, it gives us something to compare to later so we can look back. Sorry, you guys. There we go.
And so this is just an expanded view of the assessment process, and I've already talked about the evaluation and the synthesis or brainstorming component. But the thing I want to point out with this slide is you can't be afraid to reanalyze, to go back to the beginning, and to look at things if they're, during the evaluation process they're not working out in the fashion that you thought they would. So this is my favorite part. This is when we get to start opening the toolbox and start really talking about the instruments that we use in day-to-day practice.
We're going to talk briefly about types of tools, and we're going to talk about low-tech, medium-tech, and high-tech, just basic definitions of them. Low-tech tools tend to be things like a regular tape measure. Do we even have one? A regular tape measure. They're low-cost. They're portable. They're not really as precise as some things, the good old goniometer. Medium-tech tend to be more digital. They don't require external power. The costs will vary from low to medium cost. It's portable. Things like a digital camera, a laser distance meter. Even if you're comparing angles, digital inclinometer versus a goniometer are going to give you different readings based on what you're trying to measure. And then you have all the way up to your high-tech tools, things that are really application-specific. They're medium to sometimes very high cost, depending on what you're looking at. They might be transportable, or they might be really something that you're not going to move from one location to another. So it's going to change how you use that tool. A medium to high precision. And the other difference is that it usually requires a longer amount of training. It might not be something that if you have a clinic that multiple people do evaluations, there might only be one or maybe two people designated who know how to use that tool and are trained with that tool.
And something I'd like to point out here, especially in the low-tech and medium-tech, if you're looking for more information on this, the ergonomics field actually has quite a bit of information of using these tools, and just happened to be in a presentation yesterday where there was a survey in applied ergonomics that specifically said what tools are most used by ergonomists, I think is the way you say it, in the field. And it was a lot of these similar things that we're talking about, the digital inclinometer. So you can get a lot of information if you're looking for more of how to use these tools through other fields.
Again, low-tech tools, they're really, you can get them at your hardware store. When we did this presentation and started putting it together, we did a lot of shopping, actually, for some of the things that we may have been using, but we didn't always have on hand. There's really no special training required. And most people are typically familiar with how to use them. Other low-tech tools that you might not use as much, things like a fish scale or even just a simple bathroom scale, your stopwatch.
And I brought, this is simply a pitch and angle locator that you would use for ramps, stuff like that. It's a $5 piece of equipment. And then you get into more of the medium tech stuff, and that's where, you know, I just wanted a reason to buy a laser distance meter. I mean, that's really what it comes down to for presentation purposes, for stuff like that. It's great when I end up going into homes because it gives me a layout of how, you know, I can say a person is in their home and they're able to go so many feet around their home. The other thing I've started to do is to start measure anatomical measurements for people. Just the last one, we were having a hard time because of the stature of an individual of being able to measure how tall they were. And I was initially using a tape measure, and I'm like, well, wait, I don't have to do that. And I just stuck this on top of their head, and the ceiling was a reference point. And so then I was able to measure from the ceiling to their head and then from the floor to the ceiling and get an easy measurement of their stature. So there's different ways to use it. You just kind of have to be creative, and that will make the process a lot quicker. And these are just some other, just to kind of be complete. The one I will point out is I'm going to talk about a case study with the compass. So we're not just only talking about mechanical devices. The compass is a software utility that I've used when looking at computer access or looking at access for augmentative communication devices. And I'll talk a little bit more about that.
And when we talk about going from medium tech to high tech, there are some of those that it's difficult to, where do we place them? You know, how long does it take to learn to use them versus what the cost is of them? And we had a difficult time with a couple of things like software applications. Where do those fit? Is that a high-tech tool or is that a low-tech tool? And it depends on how you define it.
Yeah, the language activity monitor is another one where I would not, that was a tough one for us because it's not a high-cost item, but there's definitely some time involved in using it and making decisions based on the information you collect.
High-tech tools, we use the SmartWheel as an example. Its retail price is around $22,000 to $23,000. This is obviously not something that every clinic or every outpatient facility is going to have, but if it's a focus of your facility and of your practice that you're doing seating mobility, we'll see later that there's a lot of information you can gather from it. That's time. And there's certain pieces of information we can get from high-tech tools that we can't readily get from low-tech and medium-tech tools. It doesn't mean that we all have to have them, but if you're working on specific applications, a lot of times you can find that it's worth your investment. It usually, like this one, for example, requires a basic knowledge of computer applications. I know when I first started in PT, there were many people who did not have that basic knowledge. Having worked with pressure imaging for the last 15 years, the one biggest question I always got was, how do you put the program into the computer? I don't know how to do that. So we assume that people have that basic knowledge, but it's not always there. Tech support is usually really important for it. And this is just an example of the SmartWheel as an external device that hooks on and gives us a very nice readout that gives us a lot of information that then we have to interpret. And that's where sometimes the tricky part comes in.
And then here's just a list of other high-tech tools that, you know, Tina talked about pressure imaging. You have force plates. In the lower right-hand corner is just a transportable wheelchair scale. That was another one that we weren't sure if that was high-tech or low-tech. Very easy to use, but it's costly. So we bumped it up to the high-tech group. Data loggers and accelerometers. Those are things that, from the research side, I'd love to see researchers incorporate more into the clinical process that we don't know of any that are available right now, but that we think would be very useful in helping us make decisions, especially how people are using their mobility devices, whether it's power or manual, within the community, to keep track of how they're using that equipment. So this is where we get more into the application of these individual tools. And I think the first one, yes, is Tina's.
So I always have to bring up the goniometer. How many people here are PTs or OTs? Ooh. Engineers?
Oh!
We are really outnumbered in this group.
You know, all the presentations I've been in today, it's only been like two or three. This is great.
Yeah, it is. It's good. I always talk about the goniometer because I see it used a lot by various professionals, and we presented something similar to this at ISS, and I said, how many of you have ever read the guidelines for goniometric placement and utilization? Any of you seen the book on goniometry? How many of you? What?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you learn it. One of the things that we talk of, it's a lot of times part of the physical evaluation. So when we're talking about applying goniometric measurement to the human person, there are set practice guidelines on how to utilize this tool, and there are multiple publications describing how it's to be used. There are very specific landmarks, for example, and positions for testing for things such as hip flexion. I bring up hip flexion because I see a lot of times I see RTSs, I see engineers, I see PTs and OTs as well, go up to a person who's sitting in their chair and say, I'm going to measure their hip flexion. If I follow the correct way to get accurate and valid measurements with a goniometer, I must get them out of their chair. They must be in a supine position, and the goniometer is lined up with very specific landmarks. One arm stays stationary and one arm is mobile. So you're always referencing that anatomical supine position in most goniometric measurements. A lot of people don't realize that. So we're using tools, but not necessarily accurately or how they've been validated. And I think it's important to realize, because me as a clinician who maybe has had that training and has that background, I might get a very different measurement than somebody else who goes up to them in their chair and tries to take a measurement. Because it's very difficult to palpate things like trochanters and make sure you're lined up with the center of the femur, et cetera, when people are not in the correct position.
And the one comment I'll make there is there are times when you're not able to transfer somebody
right.
onto a mat table to take these measurements. So you just have to document the way you took them so that the next time you go back and you are working with this individual again, you're not going, hey, things are totally off. Why are they off and stuff like that? You've documented it and you've got that history.
These are some of the manuals on how this is. And some of them are basic biomechanics and how joints work and things like that and different levers. And I think it's important to realize that there is that background even into some of these very simple, very low-tech tools. And that we really need to realize that. And it's an area, for example, where my knowledge of the landmarks and where the goniometer needs to be placed might be different than Carmen's.
One of the biggest things, and I will point out Brenda Sposato here, just because she brings up an engineer's coordinate system is very different than a physical therapist's coordinate system. So that's one of the things you have to work on when working together.
Yeah. The digital camera is another tool that, you know, we use it. We probably don't use enough. How many of you regularly take photographs of your clients? Only a handful of you. A lot of people are a little bit afraid of litigation and HIPAA. That's what I hear a lot of times. But a picture really can show us a lot that maybe, or video cameras for that matter, we didn't see in the evaluation. What we talk about is what kind of shot should we take. Looking through a lot of different photographs, decided that really a side view, both left and right, because people are not always symmetrical, and a front and back view of the person. And also, how do you take the picture? If you look at these, you'll see that they're taken from two very different perspectives. We think that the best way you get the most information is if you kneel down so that the camera is level, so that the center of that person is at the center of the screen of the camera, if you're using a digital camera. Otherwise, you get some very different perspectives when you're looking down on someone or you're looking up if you're not quite in the right space. Now, this still tells us some things, but it's a little skewed because they're so different.
And the thing that I find works out the best with digital cameras is to not necessarily have the picture so you know go back while you're writing a report, but I've oftentimes used them when we're going strictly from an assessment point of view on a mat table to a wheelchair. We're evaluating a wheelchair, evaluating a seating system, and we're seeing things that just don't look right. And so it's easy to review the two and, okay, was that going on? Was there an asymmetry? Was there a pelvic obliquity at that point on the mat eval? And are we seeing that again on the wheelchair? So it helps during the assessment process.
And we talk also about making sure that everyone who might be taking pictures, because you might not be the only person seeing that person, that individual, that client, is that everybody is consistent with how they're taking the photographs. I can use it to document axle position. If I can't get a good measurement, for example, it's a quick way, and then I could even reference the photograph and take measurements off the photograph to estimate where that axle is.
And these are all, I mean, clinical estimates. You know, I know there's a few researchers in the room, so I'm putting up the big asterisk right now. You know, we're talking about quick and easy stuff that you can use within the clinical setting and still be accurate to make decisions, but yet are not going to that realm of research where you have to set everything up exactly the same every time. And this is the example where I talk about Compass software. This is, from my standpoint, a really interesting case where I was working with a student and the school district asked me to come in because the student was having trouble using the computer. And I went in, started doing the assessment, and I'm like, okay, the issue here is not the computer and the software they're using. The issue is the seating system. It's what anatomical landmark you're using for this student trying to use. She was trying to use her hand and her knee to do two-step switch scanning, if you're familiar with that, to access her AAC device and computer. So I went in, started looking at other anatomical sites, looking at other types of switches to use. And the reason I have highlighted here the left picture, one of the sites that we looked at was her lateral aspect of her head, her right, kind of the temporal area. And then on the right side there, I'm showing her arms because that's originally what they were doing. The problem there was that any switch that you put on her lap tray, she'd like to pick up and throw off. So she didn't want anything there. And then some days it would work great where she would just click the switch by making this movement. Some days it was more of a gross motor type of movement. But I didn't want to rule anything out until I kind of used some kind of assessment process.
Uh-oh.
This is what happens when you go from a Mac to a PC. Yeah. All this was showing a picture of the setup of the Compass software. So it really, it's not that big of a deal that it's not here. What's important is this slide here. What the Compass software does is it keeps track, it puts a signal up on the computer screen. In this case, it was a yellow block with an auditory feedback, an auditory tone at the same time. When that comes up, the individual's supposed to hit the switch. Well, Ashley was bored out of her mind with that and really could have cared less, wanted something more fun, more interesting. So we were doing other activities to try to get her to access the switch. The interesting thing here is that the average press time was the time it took for her to get her hand or her head or whatever anatomical site we were looking at to activate the switch. Well, because she didn't care about the interface, we really couldn't use that information, the information in white. But what we could look at was her average release time. When she activated that switch, how long did it take for her to get her hand, her head off of that switch? And the thing that we found out is up at the top, I have it looking at her head right and left. She was able to get her head on the switch very quickly, about half a second, and then off very quickly. So she wasn't dwelling on that switch. She wasn't leaving her hand on the switch. When we started looking at extremities, she was bringing her hand around and then was stuck and couldn't get her hand off. And this clearly shows that from an assessment point that the way to go is to look at her head as that control site for switch activation.
And you're not necessarily going to have that level of data if you're just observing. You might be able to observe it too, but you're not going to get any real numbers from it.
This one was a great one. A rehab tech supplier showed up one day in a clinic that I was working in, and he's using a laser system to lay out the lines on a molding system that then he sends off, I think in this case it was to Invacare. So rather than trying to use a yardstick, essentially, to try to make the drawing lines on the molding system, you can see right here, these are the lines that are coming off a device just like that in the upper right-hand corner. And that's a device that you use in a home to make the markings for when you're putting 2x4s up and building a home. So it's a nice application. And this has been a real lifesaver, I guess, for me. It's a digital inclinometer, just because the one case that I really use this, well, there's two. The one I'm showing here is a caster housing, just documenting that caster housing was at 75 degrees, so it was nowhere near being vertical. It's a quick, easy way to document that. And then I followed up by making the changes and showing that it was at 90 degrees. The other one was a rehab tech supplier had brought a biangular back for a student that I was working with, and he said, "Oh, it's fine, it's fine." I'm like, "No, the angles are too big between the lower half of the back and the upper half of the back." Well, it comes out there was about 40 degrees between the upper and the lower half of the back off of a midline. The top half was back 20 degrees, the bottom half was back 20 degrees. There was no way we could get that student's lower extremities back far enough to get proper support. And so once I did that, he's like, "Oh, okay, I'll change it." So it's a really kind of nice tool to keep everybody on the same level, I guess.
I use it a lot in doing manual chairs to look at the front end angle of a chair, because everybody always, you know, if we rolled four chairs in here, they might all have the same front end angle, but because of how different manufacturers configure their front ends, they might all look different. So it's a great tool to use for that too, so you're not ordering something that maybe the person can't use, or it changes the configuration of the whole setup.
And this is a great application that I've started using for manual mobility. Now, you could just use a tape measure. I totally agree. You could. But what I started doing is have people back up their wheelchair to a wall, to a flat surface. And then that way it allows me to get an idea of, I'm essentially using that wall as a reference point, where their shoulder is with reference to their rear wheel. And so any changes that we make from that axle position forward or back, we can document with real numbers. So you don't have to start hanging, you know, I've seen people hang plumb lines to try to figure out where the shoulder is horizontally with respect to the wheel, with the rear wheel. You could do something like this, and then the floor becomes your other access, or reference plane, and you can start measuring from the floor up. Assuming you have a 12-inch wheel, it's pretty easy to figure out where the center of the wheel is, or 24-inch wheel. It's pretty easy to figure out the center. And then you've got a vertical location for the wheel, and it's very easy then to document any changes that you make, seat to floor height, or axle location front to back.
Does anyone have any questions so far? Yeah.
Yeah.
The laser
line, is it
in the model?
Yes. The one that had the markings on the, that one. It's the alignment laser tool, and it's by PLS. And it's just called the palm laser. And this one's the PLS-2 because it does two directions. The other nice thing about this device is that within 8 degrees, it self-levels. So the table doesn't have to, that you're putting it on, doesn't have to be completely level. It'll automatically level for you.
And it's relatively inexpensive. I mean, you can pick one up at Lowe's or
Berlin's House of Tools. That's my favorite place to go, browsing.
When we start to talk about axle position, one of the things that I always bring up is, what are you measuring? Be sure that when you use these tools to take measurements, that you are being consistent and, again, documenting it. If I measure axle position, I need to know, am I measuring that relative to the person, or am I doing it relative to, say, the back cane of the wheelchair? When I go to order, for example, different manufacturers measure where their axle position is differently. So if I am measuring it and say I'm doing more of a custom type chair where my axle position is relatively fixed, I need to know what I referenced, because an axle that is, say, an inch or 2 inches forward of the acromion process when the person is sitting on the chair, if I'm ordering that chair, I need to reference the back of the wheelchair. So it may be that I have on a wheelchair order form, for example, a 5-inch center of gravity relative to the back cane, which can translate to, say, 2 or 3 inches relative to the shoulder. So it's important when we use the tools, we document and realize what we're looking for and why we're taking the measurement. Does that make sense? The Smart Wheel is a high-tech tool that we can use to look at various things related to wheeled mobility that gives us a lot of information relatively quickly. Again, it's a higher cost product and takes some time to train on, but it's really a pretty user-friendly program. And we get a printout like this. You can also get a Word document that will let me look at things that I can't readily measure. Now, I can measure distance. I can mark off distance and measure how quick they can push. But it's also very difficult, if you've ever tried, to count how many times someone makes contact with the wheels when you're trying to do a stopwatch and count how many times they push. I can get this all in one, so I can get distance. I can get the force that they're putting on the rim to propel, which I can't readily gather that data. I can get how many strokes. I can get their stroke length. Now, people say you can mark the rim and you can get stroke length, but it's a little more difficult to measure. With this, I have it all in one, and I can look stroke by stroke. It also gives me information about the startup versus my steady state. So a lot of times, high-tech tools combine some of the advantages you have from low and medium-tech tools, but give me more information that I wouldn't be able to gather from just one single tool.
And this is, at the very beginning, we talked about databases and databases being important. This is one area where a group of individuals have started putting together a database of information of not necessarily what is right or wrong, but what is typical. And so we can start looking at how people that we're working with in our own clinic compare to the typical. And how does that, how does speed compare to the average speed to be able to cross the street and things of more community-oriented types of tasks.
So it's somewhere where we're trying to take a tool from a research perspective and bring it into clinical applications. So there's different applications for a lot of these tools. One of the things we've done with the Smart Wheel is comparing wheelchairs. It wasn't necessarily these two chairs, but we looked at aluminum to titanium. And we looked at, there is a standard clinical protocol that's been developed by this users group that looks at different areas. It looks at carpet, tile, ramps, and a figure eight. And we chose tile for this. And we looked at peak torque, ease of propulsion, average torque. And you can see that I can find differences. We don't know what these differences mean at this point because we don't have normative data. But it gives us something something objective to look at and to compare to what we're seeing clinically as well.
This is just an example. One of the colleagues that we work with gave us these slides. And really, it's just showing you that motion analysis is another area that you don't necessarily get into clinically, but amazingly enough, it's amazing. It's kind of nice having your session a little bit later on in Resna. There's CPT codes that are directly related to motion analysis. Now, getting a funding source to pay for that is another story. But kinematic gait labs are another way of using high-tech tools to make clinically oriented decisions.
And obviously you can see that the amount of time that goes in, even to setting up for an assessment or evaluation, you're not going to have everyone at your facility trained in this.
And this is where it's important to have the engineer and the clinician working together to make this a smoother process.
So what do you do with all this kind of information? How many of you guys are using the tools that we've shown you so far? Some of them?
Good.
Many of them? One of the things we talk about is developing your own toolbox. And I think it's really important is that you have them with you, not necessarily in your pocket, but somewhere in the vicinity where they're accessible. If you're doing mobile, you know, assessments and going from place to place, yes, you should have them in a nice toolbox or somewhere where you can use them and know when it's appropriate to use each of them and learn how to use them correctly. For example, the goniometer. And being consistent within your facility or program. If you're an engineer, a lot of you are, and you work with therapists, is working with them to establish kind of guidelines for your facility or for your practice on who is the expert in this tool utilization, when do we use these, when might we not use them. Even when I did pressure imaging, we had certain criteria. At what point do we need to utilize pressure imaging? Because it was something that got very confusing and people wanted to do it all the time when it wasn't always necessary or appropriate, and we could start in different ways. And I think that helps if you set up models and kind of protocols for your own facility.
And in developing those protocols, one of the things that you have to do if you start bringing these tools into your setting is you almost have to apply them on a more regular basis than you normally would, just to figure out when it is truly appropriate to do it, or so that something doesn't end up getting ending up with dust on it in the corner and never get used. You just have to use them on a regular basis, and like Tina was saying, make them available.
And I think part of it, too, is a way that you can actually generate revenue for your facility by utilizing these tools accurately and efficiently, is a lot of times you can facilitate multiple visits by really using tools to get some great information and then create your treatment plan off of the information you get from those tools, and then using those tools to reassess once you've intervened. And I've seen some facilities who are doing a very good job at that have taken people, say, from seating clinic and then put them in through pressure imaging clinic and put them in through ortho clinic or put them through this, and then they bring them back for reassessment using some of these high-tech and medium-tech tools. Of course, you have to be efficient with it. Obviously, if it's going to take you a half hour to set something up every time you use it, you're going to pick and choose and determine who's most appropriate.
I mean, the last thing we hear is you have to be open-minded about the changes, especially if you're working with a rehab tech supplier or manufacturer directly in your clinic. You know, they're very used to one way of doing things, and you have to, and they may have been doing it this way for 20 years. So you have to really get a lot of people to buy into it. That's why we gave you all that information in the beginning. You don't want to just show up one day with all these tools. You really want to have a plan of action overall for the situation, for the setting that you're working in.
Well, and a great example is we did some demonstration with these tools at International Cevian Symposium, and we kind of put people on the spot and said, okay, you're going to measure this with this tool, and this tool. And one of the people was used to a specific tool and said, I'm not going to do it with this. It was too much for them to take in all at once. So
right.
You do sometimes have to introduce it and make sure people are trained appropriately. I think also is keeping up with your professional organizations, whether it's research. Research doesn't have to be difficult to keep up on. Guidelines and practice standards. If you haven't looked at your clinical guidelines or your practice standards for a while, take a look. I reviewed some of mine and kind of, they don't necessarily teach you all of them in school, but some of them were kind of surprising, actually, and the amount of detail that's in them. And look for new tools.
And if you find new tools, let me know.
Yeah. We also want you guys, we have some time to come up and kind of play around with some of, like, the digital inclinometer and the laser distance meter. We do know there's limitations. Not everybody's going to have, again, every tool. Cost and availability. Also transportability. Where are you doing your assessments? Also, sometimes we have a lot of expectations from the tools, and we expect that it's going to help us make our clinical decisions. It doesn't always work that way. We still have to make judgment calls. Based on what we see, based on the data, we need to make, sometimes it comes up to the best guess, based on all of our experience and the data that we have. It's not always going to answer our questions. Sometimes it might actually mean that we have more questions to answer now.
And one of the things that I've seen most often is when the data turns out in a fashion that's different from what you expected, and it's different from your expectations, and then you have to sit there and figure out what's going on, why did this occur, and one of the great examples I have is with the smart wheel. We had a client where we used an ultralight wheelchair versus a lightweight wheelchair, but we had set them up totally different, and we got higher forces with the ultralight wheelchair, and we couldn't figure out what was going on because it's lighter weight, and it had all to do with that setup. So it really keeps you on your toes to make sure you're providing appropriate services.
And really trying to translate that into practical application. If you don't use it, it's not going to be helpful for you. If you don't know how to use it, find someone who does and have them help you with it. I used to go to our engineers all the time, and they always said, keep the tools out of Tina's hands. But and if you're not sure of the value of it, there are value to a lot of tools that we're not using just because we're not familiar with it. And we already kind of talked about this.
Yeah. This is just
a slide we really like. You know, we always start with an idea in mind, and based on who touches it or who looks at the data or who assesses it, we might end up with something completely different than what we were going after in the first place. So tools sometimes don't lead us down the path that we're expecting.
And we've already talked a little bit about future applications of looking at tools that we can use, but that have already been developed, and ones that we, of course, would like to see different groups develop in the future. And also, we're always looking for, you know, what tools do we need? What other things can we use? You know, our goal really is to keep things inexpensive, to try not to have to use high-cost items, and to keep things so that they're transportable. I know in my practice that's really what I'm looking for. And so within those goals, we're always looking for future applications. And, you know, one of the things we had on a previous slide was reliability. You know, a lot of these things, right or wrong, You know, one of the things we had on a previous slide was reliability. You know, a lot of these things, right or wrong, have not been proven for validity and reliability and getting into more of the research aspect of it. And that purely, that has to come from that knowledge translation back and forth between the researchers and the clinicians working together.
You can also look at utilization. You might have access to high-tech tools, or you might be trying to justify them for your department. What I've seen work very well in some facilities is a crossover between the clinical application of that tool and the research application, and that there's a sharing of resources sometimes that will work, as long as it's done correctly. On the end of this presentation, and we're going to post this presentation, give it to Resna to post,
okay.
I believe. It just has a list of where you can get some of these tools. But since we have time, if you guys want to come up and play with some of the tools, we welcome you to do that.
And does anybody have any questions at this point? The case studies? Mm-hmm. We had to keep those. The case studies were those ones intermixed. We just had to keep them short because of the...
We tend to run over.
Yeah. We actually went a little bit quicker than we thought we would. There's a question from the front row, I believe. So as it being Father's Day, my family is here and my brother helped
point.
Me out with some of the demonstrations, and Caitlin is nicely pointing out that I didn't acknowledge the fact that my brother was in there. So,
any other questions?
Any other questions? All right, great. The last thing
the important thing
we have for you is you got to fill out your evaluation form, and then the number. And the number is 7718. Thank you very much.
Hello.